Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is the curious case of America's mystifying mortality at both ends of life.
How old are you?
7, but I look a lot older.
God bless you. He's 7.
Benjamin, this is my granddaughter, Daisy.
Are you sick?
They said I was gonna die soon, but maybe not.
You're odd.
Odd is right. Like Brad Pitt's Benjamin Button, we are living longer in America if we can just survive our harrowing infancy. We will explore this hour the joys of increased life expectancy in America with a singer, Marilyn May, still going strong in her 80s.
So here's to life and every joy.
And we will also try to understand at the same time why this country has one of the worst infant mortality rates in the industrialized world. Also, a war over water and how the Islamic State is using an ancient weapon in Syria and Iraq that is more valuable than oil. Plus, the Nobel Prize for Literature. We attempt to translate the winner from the French. Why does the U.S. have a life expectancy of more than 78 years? That's where we begin. We spend by far the most money on healthcare in the world, yet we also have one of the highest rates of infant deaths in the industrialized world, and that's according to the latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control. Here to help us on the infancy end of things is economist Emily Oster, visiting associate professor of economics at Brown University. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So what is going on here? Is it poverty? Is it the way we count statistics? Is it our healthcare system is able to save more high-risk babies and so our stats look bad? What's going on here?
So it's a little bit of many of those things. Some of it is about statistics and how this is reported and what we count as a live birth. And when we crunched the numbers, it looked like something like 40% of the difference between, say, the U.S. and Finland, which has a very low infant mortality rate, is accounted for by this difference in reporting. But even with that, the U.S. is doing much worse. And there are a bunch of different reasons for that, many of which do have to do with poverty.
Is it possible to say also that in many ways the infant mortality stats suggest that we really put a lower priority on the beginning of life than the end of life in the way we spend money, and that's going to be reflected in the statistics here?
I'm not sure I would have said that, because I think one of the things we see in the data is that actually conditional on birth weight, which is a good measure of how well an infant is doing when they're born, we in the U.S. are doing very well in the first week or month. So in the time period of life in which the kind of medical interventions that we're thinking of as saving babies, neonatal intensive care interventions, the things that are very expensive, those actually do seem to be buying us a lot of survival and doing very well. It's actually the period after a month of life, so a month to 12 months, where the U.S. is really doing worse. And much of the death rate in that period is not really about medical interventions. It's about things that are happening in the home.
So, all right. So I love this. We're getting behind the statistics here. The message is not that we care less about the beginning of life than the end of life. It's that we care less about people of childbearing age in high-risk populations, low-income populations, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that is a lot of the message, that the support people are getting once they're home with their babies is not very good. And in fact, we see this reflected in higher death rates throughout childhood in these populations. So this is not ending at a year. You know, that's a particularly vulnerable time. But if you look at death rates in two-year-olds, five-year-olds, you see the same kind of thing. And it does suggest that we're failing these populations in some way, that we could be doing better.
We look at the data at the beginning and end of life, and it tells us really something about the middle. Is there a correction here? Is there a fix here? Is this something we just need to live with and remind ourselves of what's going on in America?
I mean, I think it's complicated. You can think of there as being a meta correction, which is, you know, better social services and better support. That's probably would fix a lot of problems other than infant mortality. One of the things that, you know, people have talked about a lot, and I think Health and Human Services is pushing on, is some kind of more targeted support to women in this population, sort of right before and then after birth, with, say, nurses coming to your home and telling you things about, you know, how to do a better on taking care of your baby. Those kind of projects are something which are very common in Europe, which we don't have as much of in the U.S., and I think people have thought of as a possible way to try to combat some of these issues.
Well, let me jump in there. So I was looking at, you know, what makes America different, just like you are right there. And it seems to me that how we are different from some of those other countries in the industrialized world is maybe less about individual programs for young mothers and more about how those industrialized countries have a program that stays with people all through their lives. The United States has programs that start and then stop, start and then stop. We're dropping people at various places in the middle, and the statistics show there are health implications for that right here in this early part of life.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you even see it in this sort of very microcosm that basically everybody's having their baby in a hospital in the U.S., or virtually everybody. And so when we look at survival of vulnerable infants, like premature babies, across different socioeconomic groups, actually, you know, the infants of poor women do fine in the U.S. because once you're in the hospital, then you're getting a pretty good kind of treatment. It's this period later when we're sort of like, okay, here's your baby, go home. You have no resources. And that is where things are really failing. And that's where, as you say, the European model is a higher touch model throughout the life cycle.
So if you're an infant listening to this program and you're in the hospital, the message is don't go home.
Don't leave.
If you want to live longer, right?
Exactly. Don't leave.
Emily Oster, visiting professor of economics at Brown University. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so you've made it past the toddler years. You've avoided drowning and accidents. What's your personal best case scenario for the golden years?
This is Carol Dodson from Tarrytown, New York. And what I'm most looking forward to about growing old is retirement and never having to be startled awake again by the alarm clock.
Simple pleasures, Carol. You go, girl. And from Austin, Texas, eating dinner at happy hour and going to bed at 7 p.m. But consider 78-year-old Tom Choate, who became the oldest person to reach the summit of Mount McKinley in June of 2013. Okay, forget mountain climbing. American folk artist Anna Mary Robertson Moses, better known as Grandma Moses, was discovered at age 78 when a New York art dealer saw her paintings displayed in a drugstore in Hoosick Falls, New York. 78 point something. That's the life expectancy in the U.S. these days, according to the CDC. If you can survive infancy, you can write into your old age if your mind stays sharp and you have a talent for it. In 1947, French author André Gide took home the Nobel Prize in Literature. He was 78, as was Shmuel Agnon, who won back in 1966. Nice details, right? But a relative youngster won it today, a 69-year-old. He is French and less well-known than André Gide. The winner is French novelist Patrick Modiano, whose books were ranked 71,000 to 590,000 to 4 million something on Amazon as the announcement was made. Don't try to order them now. A lot of Modianos are on back order, including the Missing Person novel, described as an elliptical engrossing rumination on the essence of identity and the search for self, which might be a definition of a French novel. All right, that's a cheap shot. Carolyn Kellogg writes about books for the Los Angeles Times. She's also the vice president of the National Book Critics Circle. Hello, Carolyn.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You know, let me just get my chauvinist out of the way. I don't know him at all.
Well, that puts you in very good and large company, I believe.
What should we know about him, if anything, and how surprised were you?
Not all that surprised. He was ranked by Ladbrokes, which is a betting house in England, at like sixth going into the final stretch.
Well.
But he's much better known in France and in Europe than he is here. He has been mostly published by small independent or academic presses. And he isn't one of those hipster authors like Nausgaard,
right.
Although he seems to write like sort of mini Nausgaard-y books.
And in terms of the Nobel, why do you think he qualifies, if you do, as a Nobel author? I mean, there are a lot of obscure authors who made it to the Nobel. In many ways, it seemed as though the committee was kind to resurrect the backlist or acknowledge someone for preserving a language or a culture, that sort of thing.
A lot of times the Nobel Committee is motivated by a sense of social responsibility. So the winners are people like Toni Morrison, who are wrestling with big moral issues like the legacy of slavery. So it seems from the little bit I know of Patrick Modiano that what he's doing is looking at the closely examined life and memory, and some of that memory has to do with the legacy of World War II in France.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who didn't get the award. DeLillo, Cormac McCarthy, among the Americans, Joyce Carol Oates, who is prodigious as well as a skilled writer. Philip Roth is always talked about.
Yeah, I think of all those writers, Philip Roth is the one who people tend to think, oh, he should have it coming. But one of the judges of the Swedish Academy said very clearly that he thinks that Western literature is suffering from professionalism, from a lack of intellectual rigor. And so if he continues to be a big force on the judging committee, I think that Philip Roth has a long wait.
The Nobel Committee doesn't consider popular literature to be the kind of literature that they care about. They're definitely looking for some other set of qualities, and I'm looking at some of the other strong contenders, at least in terms of people trying to predict what the committee would do. Haruki Murakami, Ngugi Wa Thiong, these are people who are writing very much in the tradition of some of the other writers not terribly well known in the West.
That's true. I think it's interesting, though, that if you look back at the past when they did acknowledge American writers, that some of them, like Hemingway, wrote very accessibly and were big bestsellers. And Faulkner, although he's known for his like intellectual novels, he also wrote pulp novels. So the high and the low sometimes come together in a single author's work.
Well, lots of diversity in literature, and you know that's part of what the Nobel Committee is celebrating here. And we celebrated along with them the winner of the 2014 Nobel Prize for Literature, French novelist Patrick Modiano. Carolyn Kellogg writes about books for the Los Angeles Times. She's also vice president of the National Book Critics Circle. Carolyn, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I got to go read some Patrick Modiano now.
I bet you do. Water is politics. Politics you can take a shower in, you might say, especially in the arid Middle East. The Islamic State, or ISIS, is well aware of the water politics in Iraq and Syria, and they've been targeting Iraqi dams, flooding small villages to bolster their control of the region, evoking a military tradition as old as the medieval caliphate they say they want to establish in the region. Joining us is Michael Stevens, head of the Qatar office of the Royal United Services Institute for Defense and Security Studies. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
Trying to control water and using it as a military weapon is a pretty old tactic in the Middle East, an old strategy in the Middle East. Is that what ISIS is doing here?
Absolutely, it is. I think the most well-documented episode of that was when Salahuddin stopped the Crusaders near Hattin from accessing water and was able to win a fairly quick victory. ISIS seemed to not have forgotten the lessons of the past. Indeed, they've actually remembered some of the things that were going on during the occupation of Iraq by US and coalition forces in 2003 onwards, and have realized that if you can secure resources quickly, you suddenly become the arbiter not only of military power, but political power. And so that's what they've done. And what we've seen as a modus operandi really is ISIS, whenever they've moved into an area, have secured resources, be that hydrocarbons, water, flour, bread, and centralized it under their control. And they use it to punish people that they don't want either to exist in that area or that have not paid them taxes and support. And they reward those of those people that decide to follow them and decide to volunteer. It's clearly a pinpoint part of their strategy that water really is one of the most important factors.
So terror and these bizarre beheadings that herald the arrival of ISIS, while they get a lot of attention in the West, are not perhaps even the most effective tactic here. Some of these control of resources tactics are perhaps much more effective on the ground.
And what we noticed in June was that ISIS had begun shutting off water to Christian villages around Mosul, Bartella, Karakosh. And the moment that happened, particularly in areas where farming is quite an important part of the economy. These areas came under pressure almost immediately. And whilst you can behead people, you can punish people, you know, you're doing this one person at a time. Here you can isolate thousands of people almost overnight, and then basically put them in a situation where they have to negotiate with you. And we've seen a number of different cities and towns under this pressure. And it's not just the Christians, it's also Kurdish farmers that have been affected as well. So ISIS have realized that by controlling water, you can really twist the arm round the back of anybody who you don't like and anybody who looks like they're not going to pay support to you, or they're going to potentially be an enemy to you. The other thing, of course, is that it's a revenue gainer. And what ISIS have done is go to local farmers and say, listen, if you don't pay us money, we'll turn the water off. So it has the added advantage of bringing in money as well as instilling fear.
The other thing worth noting is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's nothing about cutting off water supplies that is even remotely threatened by airstrikes, right?
No, not at the moment, simply because what you can do is just simply isolate where the faucet is on the pipeline and shut it down that way. And you can turn it off at source. You can, block the dams if you want to, although ISIS actually, yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, there was a lot of noise made about the fact that ISIS captured Mosul Dam, but they didn't actually do much with it. In fact, they basically maintained it, not as well as perhaps they could have done, but they weren't interested in shutting it down. But in terms of what airstrikes were able to target, sometimes this is an individual pipeline which goes out to one village, supplying hundreds of people. And how you target that with an airstrike depends on whether you can spot the faucet from, you know, a satellite or from an F-16 or something. So it's not as easy as it seems to tie in this kind of military operation to what ISIS is doing on the ground.
Well, in fact, the media, in talking about that Mosul Dam capture earlier this year, talked almost exclusively about ISIS blowing up the dam and flooding Baghdad. But what you're saying is something much more, much more sustainable, and that is holding the dam and basically selectively using it as a weapon to cut off water to Baghdad and every city in between Baghdad and the Mosul Dam. Is that your sense of the strategy here?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to note that the Islamic State is trying to act as a state. They have 8 million people under their control, and these people need to drink water. If they had blown up the dam, they would have destroyed Mosul, which is a city of 2 million people. It's where they basically established their caliphate. I think more than the towns in Syria, it was the taking of Mosul that was really symbolic for the power of the Islamic State. It doesn't make a lot of sense, therefore, to then destroy that by flooding it under, 10 feet of water. So I think that was some alarmism, actually. And if you look at what ISIS has been trying to do, they've been trying to get highly skilled workers to come and join them, engineers. They've been looking at trying to retain the services of those people that are involved in hydrocarbon infrastructure, farming, water utilities, and trying to pay them decent salaries so that they remain in their posts, just loyal to ISIS rather than the previous regime. Mm. So they have been quite structured about this. They're not as sort of nihilistic as people have made them out to be.
Well, and this nihilism is not only alarmism, but it also misses completely the point. I mean, in some ways, being the master of the water is an ancient power in the Middle East that way predates oil and plays directly into this notion of we are establishing a caliphate, and everyone in the Middle East understands that every time ISIS speaks.
Absolutely. And actually, I mean, in terms of the most basic tenet of establishing a caliphate, if your soldiers can't drink water, you're not going to get very far. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that when the Iraqi army broke back in June, some of these frontline units, particularly further south in Anbar province, hadn't actually had supplies of water in 4 or 5 days, and they hadn't eaten either. Morale was low, supplies were low, and when ISIS came into town, they just dumped their weapons and ran. I mean, there was no reason for them to keep fighting. They had no resources to keep fighting. And ultimately, if you're going to run a slick military operation, you've got to have that control of water, particularly in a place where it gets to, well over 120 degrees in the middle of the day. And it's very, very dry and arid. And if you don't have that supplies, you really can't get very far. So it has always been a central point. If you want to expand your influence across that region, you've got to have the access to water. It is the probably most important aspect. And what I would add to this is that actually in Iraq, water is more expensive than oil per liter. So that might tell you something about how valued it is.
Michael Stevens is head of the Royal United Services Institute for Defense and Security Studies Office in Qatar. He spoke to us from London. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now on The Takeaway, a couple of joyful banjo also-rans.
When you're going out, you live in your own scene. When you need to shout, you dance in your own dream. When the night is long.
Well, at least one of us is a wannabe. That's me. I'm on backup banjo there as the one and only Mike Doty sings When the Night is Long. Mike Doty, former lead singer for Soul Coughing, and I sat down and did some banjo jamming in the studio last week. Part of an effort by The Takeaway to find musicians who like to talk about what's going on in the world as much as they like to jam.
You must have strong opinions, right?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, I'm a contrarian.
Mike Doty's opinions are strong, as you'll hear, but his solo songs are gentle and spare, like These Are Your Friends.
These are your friends. And hey, do you want to go out? Do you want to burn? Limp and knock the chumps down. Hey, do you want to dance? Seize the mysteries, hold them in your hands. These are your friends. These are your friends. These are your friends. These are your friends.
The voice of Mike Doty, former lead singer for Soul Coughing. His latest two albums are Live at Ken's House and Stellar Motel. Playing the banjo, and that's your tune?
That's my song, yeah. Well, I actually wrote the Is Change a Crime part, which, you know, is whatever, 8 bars. I wrote with Roseanne Cash, actually, a song that she rejected. And I was like, Rose, let me have those 8 bars. And she was willing. I had to beg her to take a percentage of the copyright because she was like, no, it's fine. Give me lunch sometime. And I was like, no, it's not right. Really, I just wanted to have co-written a song with her. So eventually I talked her into taking pie. 3.14.15, I think. To about 7 digits or so.
So hipstery.
Yes. I was like, will you take pie? And she was like, I'll take pie.
Roseanne is such a song maniac. I mean, she just loves this idea of there are songs and they're up there in heaven and we all are coaxing them out of heaven so that we can hear them on the earth.
Totally.
Yeah. You must have strong opinions, right?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I grew up in a conservative family with my dad was in the military. He comes from Louisiana, very conservative family down there. Many of them work in fracking.
Really?
No, yeah. And there's so many things that people that are of my political persuasion, I think, wow, how can you be so dumb? Like, people that I agree with, I tend to get into arguments with.
If you mix it up more, if you have a background like you have, you're running into people who are very narrow-minded, even though they think they're like liberal, progressive, whatever.
Indeed. And the inevitable argument you get is, but we're the smart people.
Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, they're like, no, but see, you don't understand. We're smart and we know better. And it's very disappointing, particularly if you consider the liberal credo to be, critical thought in all areas, relentless self-questioning. And it just seems – it's like you really have never met anybody that disagrees with you. You never met anybody for whom that like – that's my damn job.
Or who's in the oil business.
Who's in the oil business. No. People in my family who work in the energy industry would say, what do you think you're doing that's safer? Like the implied message when you get into any kind of argument with them is, if you think that before fracking, whatever energy you were consuming, if you think there was any less of an environmental threat, that you're dreaming.
You know? That's an interesting argument. So does this make its way into your music? This kind of stuff, these kind of issues, these ideas. You worked with MoveOn.org for a while.
Yeah. I mean, that's when I've done political messages, they've been very broad. Very broad political songs. They always come out very easily, which is really surprising. I'm fundamentally a liberal, like a liberal. And I guess I just am increasingly astonished at the people that I agree with.
And the narrow-mindedness.
And the difficulty
to have an argument. It's difficult to have a political argument in America today anyway. You know, it's not really about what the future of America is, that sort of thing.
And there's very little room for subtlety. What I always find is if I bring up like, well, you know, actually the other people think differently about fracking, or other people think differently about guns, or other people think differently about creationism, I end up being spoken to as if I'm like a creationist pro-fracker. And there's just no room for... maybe we are wrong about some things, right about other things. Maybe there are shades within our belief system, and maybe there's a level of self-questioning that's just not present.
You think it matters if the Democrats lose the Senate in 2014?
No. Here's what makes me angry. Here's what made me really angry during Occupy. Is I tweeted this at least once a day. I said, New York State Democratic headquarters is on 28th and Park Avenue South. Go there. You're not scaring Wall Street. You will scare the Democratic Party. So all that energy, have you ever walked into a primary election to a polling place? There's nobody there. There's nobody there. You get 100 people to support a progressive candidate, you will get him on the ballot or her on the ballot. I think the Republicans generally acknowledge in private that the Tea Party are loonies, and yet they brought the world economy to the brink of collapse with the debt ceiling. You know, and I hear people who considerably further to the left than I am say like, well, this, you know, the system's ever going to change. The system never serves us. Just try. Just once. Concerted effort within the system. Just once. Prove yourself right. Just do it. Just put absolutely all your energy into putting a socialist on the ballot in New York City.
Mike Doty, former lead singer for Soul Coughing, his latest two albums, Live at Ken's House and Stellar Motel Stellar. Take it away.
I was in many minds. I was in an airport bookstore. Away from many moons. Left a suitcase on the fourth floor. Enormous balloons. Gold choker made out of spoons. Eating super sugar crisp. I was getting used to this well. Light will keep your heart beating in the future. Light will keep your heart beating in the future.
Was that acceptable as a high note? Thank you.
There was a lot of them. There was a bloody fight next door. There was a crack.
By the way, since we've been talking about success in the later years, we can note that modern banjo legend Earl Scruggs lived 88 long years. He beat the average American life expectancy by a decade. You see, a child born in America in 2012 should plan on making it to 78.8 years, according to the latest statistics. What do you plan to do in that 0.8 of your, I guess it would be 79th year?
This is Mike Clem from Lakeville, Minnesota. I'm looking forward, when I retire, to teaching my grandson how to hunt, fish, and shoot, and spending as much time with my three boys as I possibly can.
Hey there, Mike in Minnesota. Take him ice fishing, if there's any ice left by then. From the land of septuagenarians, West Palm Beach, Florida, this takeaway fan looks forward to not dying early. From Fort Lauderdale, Florida, going gray before I go bald and getting to see my boys grow into men.
from Macon, Georgia. I love working, and my ideal job when I retire is a greeter at Walt Disney World. I'm most looking forward to the joy and the excitement on every face as they immerse themselves in the wonderful world of Disney. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us what you hope to be doing when you beat the average life expectancy in your old age. Our next guest has no plans to be a greeter at Disney World. If she did, she would never wear a mouse suit. She would greet as herself, 86-year-old cabaret singer Marilyn May. In fact, her agent would probably only let her perform live at Disney World because she's still packing them in at her gigs. She's performing this week to sell out crowds at the Crazy Cox in London. In 1965, she received a Grammy nomination for Best New Artist. She appeared on The Tonight Show 76 times. Johnny Carson even dubbed her the Super Singer.
Feeling good, feeling fine, feeling groovy all the time. Ain't it great just to be feeling?
Marilyn May, welcome to The Takeaway.
That's the funniest record for you to do.
Why do you think so? Why do you think so?
It's fine. It's fine. It's an RCA recording that I did years ago. Even then, I wasn't too young. I was kind of a late bloomer with RCA.
We're talking to you because, you know, in many ways, the fact that you're still going strong at 86, you're performing in London this week, right?
I am. We're at a place called the Crazy Cox. It's in Piccadilly Square. We opened two nights ago, and we've been packed full houses and incredible, beautiful, receptive audiences.
That's so great. What is your secret for hanging around?
I have great energy, and I have wonderful health. I don't stop, you know. I believe in I keep moving. I always tell people, and when you're very tired, then you push. You just push. We get on and off planes, and I'm working more than ever these days. Oddly enough, I don't know how to say no to any engagement, and don't want to. You know, I'm thrilled and pleased that we're entertaining the people. That's my job. I sing to the people, not for them. My voice is really hanging in there, which I'm very fortunate. I have a great work ethic of performing my craft.
Oh, you certainly do. Are these the best years of your life? Are there a best years of your life at this point?
I think these are the best years of my life. I've had three husbands and a meaningful love affair. And all of that was busy and happy and traumatic and unhappy. And now my love affair is with my audience.
You know, the latest statistics say that in the U.S., life expectancy is, as long as it's ever been, over 78 years. You're above that. Is there something magical about the late 70s, early 80s?
John, I always say I'm just singing as fast as I can. I'm just actually singing as fast as I can. I think you have to have a great sense of humor and not take yourself too seriously. And that's always been my, and I think you have to, even if you're really, really tired, you just push and you get up and you go do that next show, or you pack that next bag, you get on that next plane, and you do what you love to do. And that's my life.
And you know, so many people have various kinds of dreams about what they hope will be, you know, their experience when they get older, either wisdom, or they'll be able to look back, or they'll, you know, have revenge on everybody. I'm going to outlive all the bastards, you know, that kind of thing. What's the best part about being your age? And speak to the younger folks here.
Well, I have great friends, and I have six friends that followed me here. They came from the States because I was going to appear in London, and they wanted to experience that. And and it's been it's a joy to have that kind of friendship. I really am so busy learning the lyrics and doing what I do. You know, there's a great lyric in a show called "Here's to Life" that I sing, and it starts out, I've learned that all you give is all you get, so you give it all you've got. And you know, my mantra in life is called "It's Today," and Jerry Herman wrote it. It's part of the American Songbook from MAME, and it's light the candles, get the ice out, roll the rug up. It's today, you know, and every day is I attack every day. It's an adventure. My life is an adventure and always has been. I'm very interested in things and people, and I like to know what your life. In fact, you and I will talk when we're off the air. I know it's not your interview, but I want to know all about you, John.
Me, I'm just, you know, I'm a youngster in my late 50s. I got 5 kids. I've had a radio show for 7 years. I've used a wheelchair for 38 years.
Right. You have 5 children.
Yeah, I had a car accident, but I'm going strong.
And see, you push, don't you?
I push
yourself.
Yeah, I literally push the chair. That's right. I mean, I take your lesson quite literally.
Believe me, you'll last a long time with that philosophy.
I'm glad to hear it from someone who knows. What is that melody? It's today. How's it go?
Oh, here's to life is no complaints, no complaints, and no regrets. I still believe in chasing dreams and placing bets. And I have learned for all you give is all you get. So you give it all you've got. So here's to life and every joy it brings. Here's to life. To dreamers and their dreams. It goes on and on and on.
And on and on and on and on. Marilyn May is an American cabaret singer, 86 years old. Going strong, folks.
So here's to life and every joy it brings.
Things that I most look forward to about growing old are, 1, science, so I don't have to actually grow old. 2, pulling pranks on children and then blaming it on my age, of course. 3, seeing my children become more than I am. 4, time in the day to use as I please. And 5, proving to myself and others that old is a state of mind, even if it is a highly medicated one. So, illness, aches, and pains, here I gracefully come.
Thanks to all our listeners at any age, especially the highly medicated Isabel Mercedes calling from Sunrise, Florida. Ambitious dreams. On Facebook, Bert writes, I dream of giving even less of a crap what other people think when I get old. John adds, yelling at the kids to get off my damn lawn, wearing my trousers up to my armpits, checking my dentures at all the attractive ladies that walk by. Good times, he says, from DeKalb, Illinois, eating whatever I want and accepting the fact that I'll die with my arteries clogged, but with many memories of delicious fried food. And Bettis writes on Facebook, I'm in my early 30s now. What I think I look forward to most is understanding the world and people better. That's a good one. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.